Marcus was reporter and managing editor for the Tribune for decades. A Scranton Central and Penn State graduate, Lou also served as editor for multiple publications, including several of his own magazines. Lou has been a consultant for over 24 political campaigns, is a board director at the Wright Center, and promoted numerous concerts, including The Grateful Dead, Fleetwood Mac, and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. We asked Lou to join us on the News Engine podcast today to discuss one of the region's most infamous unsolved crimes, the murder of Scranton school director Tommy Genova back in 1981. Tommy Genova was shot on his way into the building, and 42 years later, the crime remains unsolved. Welcome to the News Engine podcast, Lou.
Pleasure to be here, Ed.
Now, you're not just a reporter covering a crime. You were a close friend of Tommy Genova's. Help set the scene for us prior to the news of Tommy's shooting breaking inside of the room. You were in the school administration building covering a regularly scheduled school board meeting. Take us inside the building on January 26, 1981. What was going on there? It's a typical meeting, but then something happens.
So the evening started out like any other school board meeting started out. I arrived maybe 10 minutes before the meeting was scheduled to start, watched the school board directors all come in. If my recollection is correct, Tommy was the school board president, and there was the central chair empty. So I think it was Dorothy Kyrus, who was the vice chairman, chair lady. She started the meeting. And it was kind of odd that Tommy wasn't there. And they mentioned that it was kind of odd that Tommy wasn't there. Tommy was a rising politician. And when you say he was a friend of mine, it's kind of an interesting concept of friend. He wasn't somebody I'd go drinking with. He wasn't someone that I would spend some time with. I wasn't in his house. He wasn't in my house. But in those days, there were certain people, I won't say politicians, just people in the news who you met and struck up a nice chemical relationship with. It was pleasant. And Tommy was one of those guys.
So you had a lot in common. You had same, you know, interest in music and things like that.
Well, Tommy was a rock and roll star when I was just a little pup in grade school. He was maybe a whole class ahead of me. As a matter of fact, he got married when I was a junior in high school. So he was significantly older than me. But I remember him from the Rocky Glen days when it was rock and roll, and Tommy was a rock and roll star. He had cut records. He was in bands that I had friends in the bands. So while he was on the periphery of my knowledge, everybody knew in those days Tommy Genova because, like his record says, he was a lover, not a fighter.
Right. So his, you know, when we say cut a record, you know, there's a lot of people who maybe, you know, cut a record, but they were actually playing his stuff on WARM, and he was, you know, like in a hot rotation on the radio.
Oh yeah, he didn't just cut a record.
Right, right.
I mean, his record was very famous. The one actually crept up on the charts, I'm a Lover, Not a Fighter. He had other songs, and he was backed up by some doo-wop groups in Scranton that also had number one hits on Warmland. So he was famous in his time.
So, and he was well-known outside of politics.
Yes.
Well-known
so
guy.
People knew him, and he had that kind of personality that you can win over a hard-boiled reporter in an instant. he won over a whole town in an instant. I mean, his emergence into the school board was what everyone said was just the first step in what would be eventually an interesting political career.
I was just going to ask you about that. So school board, or maybe in some cases city council, they tend to be launching pads for folks who are serious about getting into politics. And you believe that was where Tommy was headed. He was just starting at the school board. He was just getting warmed up.
Yeah, there was a theory at the time about his murder being wrapped up in politics, though I don't think that was the case, because politics, you can lose in politics a whole lot easier than getting shot. You don't have to go to that trouble to get someone out of the political structure. But they were talking about him being mayor, and that was a normal pathway. You'd get elected to the school board, a gratis job, and then you'd move up to city council. You actually got paid maybe $3,000. And then what you wanted to do was mayor. And then from there, either you were mayor for 2, 4, 5 years, 6 years, and then you'd move on to something else, maybe a state office or state representative or something
state
like
rep,
that.
State senator, something like that. So you're in the building and you're at the school board meeting. How did the room first become aware of the shooting outside? You said you and I had talked about this. You said that you guys didn't hear the shot from inside. So you're at the meeting and something must have happened to let the folks in the meeting know that there was a shooting outside.
So there's a horseshoe table in the front where the board directors and the solicitor and the superintendent sat. And then there's a bunch of chairs. And in the back of the room was two or three desks. And I was at one of them. My co-part from the Times was at another one of them. Maybe there was someone there from a radio station or a television station. And I was the guy who got the first news. This was pre-cell phone days. And all of a sudden, a copy boy from the Tribune is at the door, motioning me. And I'm motioning him to come over because I'm covering the school board. It's okay for him to walk in the room. And he whispers to me, "They just shot Tommy Genova down in the parking lot. Get the reaction." My first thought was, get the reaction? I have to tell these people.
You have to tell the people in the room what just happened. So nobody in the room knows that, first of all, there's been a shooting outside, but secondly, that it's been the school board president who was just shot. So you're now tasked with telling the room what happened and then getting the reaction to it?
As it turned out, I didn't have to get the reaction because then one of my coworkers, Mitch Grahowski, shows up on the scene. I'm going to cover the reaction. You cover the school board. Bobby Reesum and Bobby McCarthy are downstairs in the parking lot. They're covering the murder. As a reporter, I wanted to cover the murder. I was fourth string now on this situation.
What happens with the school board meeting? Does a school board meeting just continue, or did they just pull the plug on it?
Both. It was actually mayhem. People were running for telephones. I don't know who they were calling, but everyone was running for a landline in somebody's office or another. On the floor that the meeting room was. Maybe an hour later, things calmed down enough to resume the school board meeting, of all things. I don't actually recall how it resumed or what actually transpired. Maybe they just adjourned at that point. But I know they all sat back down maybe an hour later and continued it. I don't know what kind of story I wrote, but my mind was not in the school board story.
Sure, I can imagine. So when you walk out of the building, you said the room was mayhem, but at some point you all have to leave. And when you leave, you're essentially walking out into a crime scene.
And no access to it. By then it was all cordoned off. There was cops there all night, so no one can get and disturb the crime scene. I didn't really actually find out the details until I got to the office.
And your reporters who were covering it that night, Bob Reese and Bob McCarthy, they covered the murder. But reporters always have hunches and theories and, they talk to people. So I'm sure at that point you all discuss your various theories as to what could have happened. Certainly as the early days of the investigation went on, you guys discussed it. What were you guys thinking? It had to be a real shocker, right?
It was baffling. First of all, Scranton wasn't the kind of town where you just shoot your top political executives. So here was a school board president, shot like a dog in the dead of night, and theatrically, because he was actually coming to a meeting that he was chairing. We didn't know what to make of it. And we actually didn't know what to make of it in all the contexts that you find Tommy Genova. Was it because of his relationship with the school board? Or was it his job? He had a business. His business was trash hauling. That was a dirty business. I mean, literally and figuratively. So we didn't know how that played out. Was it a rivalry? Was it a gang rivalry? Was the rumors true that the organized crime was involved in trash hauling? Was this a organized crime muscle situation? And then the stories, as gossip tends to rear its head, becomes about lovers' triangles, or maybe a lover's quadrangle, or two triangles, or, and now the stories are spinning. And I'm sitting there thinking, poor guy, and his poor family. All these stories are spinning because the cops have no idea what's going on. District attorney has no idea what's going on. Nothing is coming to fruition. And it starts to get, here's the technical term, weird.
So the case doesn't really go anywhere. And there's not a lot of evidence. You once wrote an article describing the manner in which Tommy was killed, including the type of bullet that was used. It eliminated any markings on the bullet that could connect it to the weapon used in the shooting. Can you explain that a little bit? It was a 22 caliber bullet placed inside of a plastic jacket that allowed it to be fired from a 30-06 rifle. Does that sound right?
Yeah, and that was my introduction to bizarre ballistics.
Yeah, the weirdness of this case, right?
I had no idea that this even existed. And if it wasn't for Bob McCarthy at the Tribune, I wouldn't even have known how it worked. Bob was a gun fanatic, liked them, had them, and knew about them. And we also read Popular Mechanics magazine on a regular basis, so he knew how this all worked. So this was a strange one. He was killed with the 22 bullet. It left no markings. There was no... In a rifle, you have, inside the barrel, you have spiralings. And that's what causes the bullet to turn and when it to increase velocity and to be true on its target. And when that happens, you get, I forgot the term, stripping, you get markings. You can identify that rifle by its markings on the bullet. Because this had a plastic cap on a 22 or plastic overcap on a 22 bullet, didn't leave any of that striking, that marking. And you'd shoot it from anything. Our summation was that the logical rifle would be the rifle most people used to hunt deer, which was at that time a 30-06. And that was the measurement of the barrel. So the barrel was bigger than a 22. So you needed this accelerator cover to make the 22 bullet fit into the 30-06. My first question was, why don't you shoot him with 30-06? Who was going to hear it?
And do we have any sense of how close or where the weapon was fired from? It wasn't point blank range, right? It was.
In retrospect, with all due respect to the police department, I don't think they're as sophisticated as we can do these things now. So I don't think they actually got an angle of firing or a distance concept. It was in my head that the perfect shot would be from the roof of the Ukrainian Center, which was the building behind the school board. But it could have been from the old Scranton Hotel, which was across the street. Or it could have even been further if someone was a better marksman. But hitting a guy in the head from more than 100 yards is a spectacular shot.
Sure. And it's pitch black. It's not a well-lit parking lot. It's, you know, behind the building, right?
And it's cold. And yeah, if you're waiting there in the cold, you know, who does that?
So they know that Tommy's going to be there. They know he's going to be at the meeting. So that part of it is easy. But the rest of it gets really complicated. You had mentioned Tommy's waste hauling business. And, you know, that's an easy place to point. Fair or not, there's almost always a supposed connection between organized crime and waste hauling. But that angle never really amounted to anything beyond conjecture, right? I mean, that was just somebody said, oh, he's in the waste hauling business. Maybe crime or organized crime is connected to it. But no one ever presented anything like that, right?
That was street talk.
Yeah.
That never entered anything I ever wrote or that Bobby Reese or Bobby McCarthy ever wrote. It just wasn't an element in there, but it was like, well, what are the motives? As in the same thing with Lover's Triangle. Tommy was a family man. He loved his family dearly. All he wanted to do was go home to his family. That doesn't mean that anything else could have been going on. But it was kind of another one of those things where shot by the mob, nah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. They would do it cleaner than that. And don't have to go, you could just walk up to him in the alleyway there when he pulls his car in and shoot him in the back of the head, and that's the way it's done. This, if he was on time, he'd be getting out of the car with other people.
Which makes any, you know, theory about, you know, how he was targeted or why he was targeted, it makes it that much more complicated because, you know, if somebody was there to kill Tommy Genova, I mean, obviously that they were there to kill Tommy Genova, but like you said, he shows up on time. Now he's surrounded by people and those people are now witnesses. So there's an odd, you used the word weird earlier on. It gets a little weirder the more you try to break it down and think about it.
Yeah. If other school board directors were getting out of their cars in the parking lot, they would have at least had an idea from sound where that shot was coming from. But none of that happened.
And was Tommy notoriously late for meetings? Or you,
that I don't recall, but I don't think so. I mean, it 5 minutes, the whole meeting would have been late 5 minutes.
Sure.
But this was probably, and I don't recall it precisely, but this was probably waiting for him 15 minutes or so.
One of the theories that came out of this actually wound up going to trial. A City of Scranton man was not only charged with the murder, but the case goes to trial, and the trial had a very abrupt, if not even a shocking ending. Tell us a little bit about that. So they take the City of Scranton man to trial, and after days of the trial, Ernie Preate just says, nope, can't prove this.
So the background for me was that as a young reporter, I was second string in a lot of different things. And so whenever someone was out at the county courthouse or at the federal building, okay, Marcus, go down there and cover that beat today. So I actually, at this point, had a lot of trial experience. I was covering lots of trials, enjoying covering trials, knew a lot about them, and had access to the judges so I can go in afterwards and say to the federal judges, Judge Conaboy, Nealon, not Conaboy, he wasn't on the bench at that time, what just went on? And he'd explain it to me very nicely. Or I'd go in and see Judge Kosick on the county side, and he'd say, well, Lou, here, let me give you a law lesson. So when the district attorney, Ernie Preate, stopped this trial of a man that he had charged with the murder, right in the middle of it, I mean, not even in the middle of it, in the beginning of it, just said, the trial's over, I'm dropping the charges. It was a real shock to me because I had never seen that done in court.
Have you ever seen it since?
I don't think I've seen it since either.
I mean, that is so out there, right? That's just a couple days in, right in the beginning of the trial, he just says, nope, I can't prove this, I'm done.
We're in an age now where the exact opposite is true, as we're seeing in the investigations into political persons these days, where we're constantly heard, justice is slow because no district attorney, no U.S. attorney is going to bring a charge that he doesn't think he has 100% chance of getting a conviction. Here was a situation where, obviously in Ernie's mind, he didn't have 100% conviction that here was a person who was guilty of this crime. And as it turned out, I don't know what it was that changed his mind, but he dropped the charges.
And Ernie didn't lose a lot of cases. Ernie wasn't, you know, he was a pretty flamboyant guy. He was pretty outspoken. He was a bit of a showman. So it really didn't fit his character, right? To be the kind of guy who's going to bring a case, like you said, to trial that he couldn't prove. That was not part of his makeup.
The only case that Ernie liked was a case that he'd win.
Publicly win, right?
And, yeah. Well, that was my second part. And the best one was when he got headlines. And he worked at that.
Yeah, so this was not the kind of headline Ernie wanted.
This is a terrible situation for him. And to this day, I don't know who he explained that to, if he ever explained it to it. I asked him, and he never explained it to me. Now, I asked him when I was covering him, and then I asked him when we had become professionally friendly. And I no longer was working for the Tribune, and he no longer was a district attorney, and he still wouldn't answer the question.
I thought I read somewhere. I'm certain I read somewhere as I've been pouring through this, you know, every little piece of this case I could find to just see if I could get some sense of it. But he hinted that he had a theory about who killed Tommy Genova, but he had no evidence, and that never went anywhere. Do I have that right? I guess at some point there was word that maybe there was three people out there that were persons of interest, but never really went anywhere, right?
There was a, and this is in the public, so I'm not saying anything that we haven't read over and over and over again, but there was an employee that Tommy had by the name of Joey Cavazza, I believe his last name was. I'm not sure that's the way it's pronounced. But Joey apparently was Ernie's prime witness. And there was something else going on with Joey and the law, and he wound up going to jail. And I think going to jail changed the situation, but I don't know any more than what I'm just saying right now about how it changed, what it was. But Ernie said, I can no longer rely on his testimony. I think what he told the authorities was not true, and therefore, I don't have a case.
He just couldn't do
anything
with it.
And that's about as far as it went. And he never told me what that was or how it went. Probably trying to preserve the integrity of the situation to move forward, but it never did move forward.
Sure. And to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't a lot of evidence to work with. They have an untraceable bullet and they've got a footprint in the snow. And I believe that was eventually sent off to the FBI crime lab, but that's about it, right? There wasn't a whole lot of evidence beyond that.
So Scranton police, who knows what they're doing? Maybe not a lot of great technical ability, but they know what they're doing in a crime scene. Covers this. Detective Bureau's good at this time. They do good work. They call in the state police. State police is like, in our minds, and that's like calling in the FBI. These guys know what they're doing. It goes nowhere there. Somebody, for some reason, calls in the FBI, maybe because it was a crime against a politician, and still didn't go anywhere, which is kind of really bizarre that you have these premier legal agencies not being able to get anywhere closer on the story.
It's an odd situation where nobody's talking, there's no witnesses, you've got almost no evidence, and three well-established crime investigating units, Scranton police. We don't have a lot of unsolved murders here in the city of Scranton. Police do a good job here. Like you said, state police, FBI, nothing, just like that. No one is charged and it stays an unsolved crime.
So exploring weird for just a little bit longer, right in the middle of all this investigation, I mean, not even in the middle, right at the beginning of this investigation, a state trooper gets involved in looking around. I'm not even going to say investigating. I'm saying looking around because he had no business being in the middle of this investigation. Tommy's brother, Nicky, he was a state trooper. He was a state police investigator, and he was in the middle of the story. How anybody let him anywhere near anything is beyond my understanding. But I also understand if my brother was shot and I was told to stay off the case, I wouldn't. But he didn't get anywhere either. Or if he did, it didn't go anywhere.
So was he officially investigating or he was just snooping around as best he could on his own, like you said, brother of the deceased, just trying to see if he could dig something up or make sense of something?
I believe he was told to stay off the case.
And he may have. That's almost like a made-for-TV thing where, you know, you tell the cop, hey, Marcus, you can't be on this case.
Give me your gun and badge. Yeah, right. You still go out and do it.
So here's a guy who was going to dig until there was no digging left to be done. Brother of the deceased can't come up with anything.
And I'll mention this. Tom McCarthy was probably one of the best investigative reporters I've ever seen worldwide. He couldn't get anywhere. Bobby can get a story out of a piece of stone, and he couldn't get anywhere on this story.
Wow.
Bobby Reese was a phenomenal City Hall reporter. His contacts didn't give him anything.
Nobody knew a thing. And about 10 years ago, at that time, District Attorney Andy Jarbola said that there were three persons of interest, two of whom were still alive, but they never had enough evidence to tie anyone to the shooting. A couple of years ago, District Attorney Mark Powell said it's still an active investigation, but you've been around long enough to know 42 years later, how active could it possibly be, right?
As far as I'm concerned, it's not a cold case. It's a chilly case. It's where are you going to go with this? Who's going to remember? I mean, when you asked me to come in here today to do this podcast with you, I actually wondered if I can remember anything.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I was reading some notes about the articles, and this kind of struck me, and I wanted to run this by you to see if you thought this was a little odd or if you remembered it, because, I mean, you're going back so far, and it's hard to juggle the dates, but I realized there was an unusual amount of murders that occurred in Scranton during a 3-year span, late 70s into the early 80s, starting with the Nicholas Carabin murders. Then there were four other murders, and that was all before the murder of Tommy Genova. Is it possible that maybe it was something as easy as a very overmaxed or overtaxed police department? I mean, a bunch of murders in a short period of time. It could it be something as simple as that? These guys are just overworked doing cases that aren't typical to Scranton.
Oh, Ed, you bring up something kind of very interesting.
Okay.
another name I haven't thought of in 40 years. The Carabin murders amounted for most of what you researched. And it was all done by this guy Carabin, a school teacher, who his motive was to create a pattern of a madman killing, an indiscriminate madman out killing people for the sheer sake of killing people, so that when he killed his wife, it wouldn't fall to him.
It would just look like
a madman out there.
Serial killer. Yeah.
And the irony, of course, was that this guy turned himself into the madman killer he thought he was trying to portray. He became that madman killer. So that crime spree, it was all one person, I believe. I mean, I don't know what else was going on at the time period, but I covered that, and I covered his trial. That was 2 weeks in Harrisburg. What an ordeal. So those murders were just that school teacher with a rifle and a strange motive.
So my original thinking was that maybe we had a city police department that was just trying to investigate an awful lot of stuff in a short period of time, but probably not it is what you're saying, that case was kind of signed, sealed, and delivered. They kind of knew what was going on with that.
Yeah. Early on, I bet it was a real, oh my God, we got a murder spree going on in town. But then when they finally linked it all to Nicky Carabin, it all became, okay, relax. We don't have four madmen out here shooting people. We just have this crazy guy.
What does your gut tell you, Lou? It's 40 some years later. Is the killer still walking around the streets, or any sense, any guess, any hunch, any gut instinct about this, either, where the killer is, if even still alive? Or have we seen the end of this as the curtain set, so to speak, on this investigation?
Well, based on everything we've talked about, everything I've thought about over the years, and I've gotten a few reminders along the way. It seems like every 10 years, some television station or radio station will dig up a cold case, and it'll be this one. And they'll interview one of the members of the family, and that just plunges me back to that whole black night. But one of the things I've carried through this whole thing is the concept that because it's never been prosecuted, because of that bullet, it sure seemed to me to be a professional hit. So you don't go to this much trouble in a crime of passion. If you're a disgruntled waste hauler, there's so many other ways you can put the guy out of business. If you're upset about his rise in politics, there's so many ways you can smear a guy, you don't have to shoot him. It all gets down to somebody must have paid somebody money to shoot him, and why? I don't know.
All these years later, do you still have any contact with the Genova family? Do you ever hear of or talk to them, or get any sense of, where they're at with this? Obviously, there's no closure for them. Tommy's wife has passed away. His son has passed away. I know he's got a daughter that's still alive.
Yeah, I had no relationship with them. My whole entire relationship was with Tommy. As I said earlier on, it was a professional friendship. It wasn't a personal friendship. Never in his home. He was never in mine. I didn't know Pudgy, which is a terrible nickname for a young lady by the name of Mary Lou. Yeah,
I saw that, and I chose not to. I didn't know if it was a nickname that she was appreciative, so I thought, no, I'll just let it go.
I didn't know her name was Mary Lou until all this came out.
How about you? It's got to be hard, though, to just let it go. Have you done any independent investigating over the years? I know you've thought about what could have possibly happened, but have you spent any considerable amount of time trying to figure it out or track anything down?
I had my own nonsenses going on in terms of investigations that I wouldn't let go of, that were pretty well consuming and didn't go anywhere. So we were kind of used to, in the newsroom, of having two or three things going on in the back of our head that never amounted to conclusion, which always bothered us, but was part of life. I trusted Reese and McCarthy that if anyone was going to get the story, it was going to be them. So I didn't go near it. And I really didn't want to go near it. It was the kind of story you want to go home and take a shower after you get exposed to it. It was just, why do I know this? So it was just too many things, too many unsubstantiated things that were ugly going on in the back of this story. The love triangle aspect, which was never anything other than gossip. The mafia hit story, which how do you prove? And business relationship story. Ridiculous. I mean, it wasn't there. The guy got killed and we couldn't find out why.
And there's no clear or obvious path to any motive, any explanation. I mean, here we essentially have, like you said, somebody who was a rising star in the local political community. He's literally assassinated outside of his entry into a public meeting, and we've got nothing, just nothing. I mean, you've spent decades covering. Can you think of another case that's even remotely like this? That's there's any hint of anything like this? Just to me, coming into it, you know, I was a kid in high school when this happened. It just seems to me like cases like this don't go unsolved.
I know it's a cliche, but it's certainly true in my estimation. Everybody makes a mistake. Everybody forgets to do something. There's a checklist of how do you do this crime and not get caught. Someone always forgets one item on that checklist. Not in this case. This was a real strange one, or weird, as I said before. Nothing on that checklist was missed. We don't know where that bullet came from. We don't know who shot it. We don't know how it was shot. We don't know what weapon it came from. There's no ballistics match. We don't know what Tommy business-wise was involved in. These were pre-computer days. You can't go do a search on his bank account, though you could, I guess, at the bank. But it's not easy, and probably didn't even think about it at the time. Maybe they did. I don't have the privilege of being inside the investigation that never came to fruition. If there was actually a trial, it would all come out. But it never was a trial. It didn't all come out. So as a reporter, there was so much I didn't find out about what was going on inside the police department, which was usually a sieve. We usually can find out anything that's going on in the police department. The district attorney's office, a little bit harder to find out, but come on, it all leaks. State troopers? I had my ways in and out of that police, but usually that was even a harder clam to crack. Nobody was talking. Nobody had anything. It wasn't that everyone was silent for a reason. They were silent because they didn't know what to say. They didn't have anything. As best as they are, and I think these guys were good. All of them that investigated this, I think they're all good.
And 42 years later, nothing, just absolutely nothing. So closing thoughts on it. Does this one kind of stick in your craw a little bit? You had mentioned before, there's always a couple of unsolved cases or things that, you know, you just kind of always have in the back of your mind. And it's just tough to let go. Does this one pop into your head from time to time and you just wonder, you know, how did this one get away?
Yeah, it's the one that won't leave me alone. It's really, and I have a ton of stories that you would think I wouldn't be able to leave alone, or I've left alone, but I shouldn't have left alone. There's a bunch of things that you just dead end on. Okay, you can't get any farther than this. But this story had so many twists and turns. Something had to lead you to a piece of information that would be key, and it never did. And sometimes you just wake up in the middle of the night, and there it is. I've woken up in the middle of the night a bunch of times in 40 years, and it never was there.
It was never there. Tribune reporter Lou Marcus, thanks for taking the time to talk to us and relive some of these admittingly uncomfortable memories, important memories nonetheless. I have to think this is one of the most notorious unsolved crimes in Northeast PA history. Am I out of line when I say that? I can't think of another one.
In a civilized society, you don't shoot your politicians. In a civilized society, you don't shoot anyone, but you certainly don't shoot high-profile people. The other weirdness is, why that spot? Were they making a statement? Is this not only a perfect crime, but a perfect message? And who were they sending that message to? A lot of ends here. And they just keep unraveling and unraveling, but just unravel. Usually when things come to a denouement, poof, there it is. There's no poof in this one.
All questions, no answers.
You're right.
Lou Marcus, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.